total commitment to our university's excellence, which I know you share. At times, this has meant serving as a cautionary voice when we have sensed that well-intended policies could jeopardize the qualities that have made this flagship campus the pride of the state and one of the great public universities in the world. Like you, members of the Urbana Senate feel a deep pride in membership in our campus and in the wider University of Illinois community. On behalf of the Urbana Senate, please accept my gratitude for continuing to keep the lines of communication open. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions.
I don't have a slide number, Joyce, but you said that there was a, you have a report on the admissions practices. And is that something that you might share with us? Or?
I would be glad to ask that the entire report be forwarded to the full board. It is quite an extensive report, and I've summarized it simply by saying that I believe that they documented four attempts to breach our firewall.
To give me a sense of magnitude of the length of the report, would you say it's shorter or longer than Ed's committee's
I hope it's shorter.
Okay.
Pick on Ed, Dave.
I think it might be helpful for us to see what your thoughts are on that subject. You talk about academic programs and 15 programs revised, and then 9 new minors. And how about any closures?
Yeah, this is a very good question. My colleague Abbas Amin Mansour, who chairs the Educational Policy Committee, is here to correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that the only proposal to close was in aviation in terms of academic programs. The previous year, I believe that there were some proposals to end programs that really had not been active, and those were acted upon without any sort of disagreement or fuss, in large part because they were initiated by the programs themselves.
You know, in about the fourth or fifth slide, you talk about protecting our core academic mission and in a time of more limited resources, you know, understanding what that core is and how to prune back to it. It's something that we need to struggle with at some point. And I don't know that we've done a particularly good job pruning back to the core or identifying what process should be embraced in order to prune. And that may be something that we should discuss in the coming year. You know, how should we do that in an effective manner?
I think that we have seen an example of that in the discussions about the programs in the Institute of Aviation, particularly the pilot training program. One of the difficult points to grapple with in the Educational Policy Committee, and I hope Abbas will forgive me for speaking for the committee, was precisely this question: to what extent is that particular program essential to our core academic mission? The answers were not the same from everyone, but I believe that it is fair to say that the question was raised, and the Chancellor also will correct me if it is not his perception that this was a central question. I believe it was. So I believe we're beginning to ask precisely that sort of question. I think that the structure provided by Stewarding Excellence is absolutely the right structure to use in order to address those questions, because it's a structure that is, in an essential way, involves those who will be affected by any change of policy.
I enjoyed reading those, but very few of them recommended the closure of any particular programs. And truthfully, I don't think we would have arrived at that decision regarding aviation if it weren't for the, I would describe, bold leadership and courage of the Chancellor, who dealt with a lot of personal animosity and leading us to a place that, you know, eventually arrived at conclusion. But it would have been easy to, you know, kick that, you know, to push that decision off and off and off and off. So I just don't think it's not a reflection of you, it's really a reflection of our capacity to do a good job pruning, and I don't believe I understand how we do that well. And we can discuss that in the future. I'm just throwing it out.
Thanks, Chair Kennedy. I'll just point out that in addition, it was the recommendation of our own Senate Policy Committee, Educational Policy Committee, that the program be closed.
Yeah. which we appreciate.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Nick, would you join us, please?
Okay, hi everyone. I'm Nick Berbulis. This is another in a series of talks that the Senate's conference is sponsoring to discuss different aspects of the working lives of faculty that we feel like we want to share with you. If I'd had more time, I would have rendered this in verse, but I didn't know that poetry was on the agenda today. At the last board meeting, John Martin talked about teaching in the classroom. This meeting, I'd like to talk about the very important, indispensable teaching that takes place outside of the classroom. One of the big mistakes people make is thinking that our teaching load could be measured by how many hours a week professors spend in the classroom. This makes a fundamental mistake in failing to understand our responsibility to prepare our students professionally and not just academically. This professional preparation takes place largely outside the classroom. For all students, but especially for graduate, master's, and doctoral students, classroom activities are not sufficient to provide them with the broader set of professional capabilities, attitudes, and dispositions that often make the difference between someone who gets a job and keeps a job successfully and someone who does not. Take research, for example. Learning to become a researcher, whether it is a bench scientist, an historian, or a clinical investigator, happens mostly not in classes, but in laboratories or libraries, working on research grant projects, or as a research assistant for a faculty member engaged in primary scholarship. In humanities disciplines where single authorship prevails, this teaching may take other forms, working one-on-one with students in lengthy office conferences, in reviewing drafts of their writing, and giving them feedback to help them clarify their ideas and find the best forms for expressing them. These supervised apprenticeships, if you will, are where the skills and the tacit knowledge of actually doing research get formed. You can't tell them to students. They can't learn them from reading a book. They're formed through real experiences gained in the research environment and in doing primary research. Providing such experiences to our students and guiding them through it is a major part of our work in a research university, and in sheer hours, it dwarfs the amount of time we spend with them in the classroom. In fact, it is important to realize that for most of us, there is no sharp line between the conduct of our research and our teaching. Our research informs and improves our teaching. Involving students with our research is a form of teaching. Engaging in presenting and debating new research knowledge is a teaching activity, and often it is we who get taught. People sometimes complain that faculty spend too much time in the lab and not enough time teaching. There are instances where this is a problem, perhaps, but in general, it is a false dichotomy. Faculty at a research university are teaching when they're in their labs. Similarly, in many professional fields, field experiences or internships are an essential part of professional development. University faculty, sometimes working with experienced colleagues working in these fields, model and mentor for students the skills of effective professional practice. Both elements are crucial. Modeling, I believe, is a seriously underappreciated aspect of teaching. How we do things, how we conduct ourselves in a professional field, how we treat people, how we go about our work, are things that students observe every day. I suspect that over time, these tacit aspects of modeling have as much or more actual influence on students as anything we tell them explicitly. We show them the conduct and skills of successful practice, and they pick up these patterns, consciously or not, in ways that have a lasting impact on them. Good teachers realize this, that you're always teaching, even when you aren't intentionally doing so. Mentoring is the other aspect of this process. It's highly individualized, and you need to treat every student differently. Some students need to be patiently encouraged. Others need a kick in the rear, figuratively speaking, of course. Some need their egos boosted. Others need their egos taken down a notch or two. Some need a lot of explicit advice and guidance. Others need to be sent off on their own for a bit. Some fear mistakes and failure. Others recognize these as potential learning opportunities. As a teacher outside the classroom, you get to see a lot of your advisees and mentees, and their education, and hence your teaching, are going on all the time. You can't measure that with a time clock. As you move to the doctoral level especially, I think that the relative importance of classwork diminishes even further.